It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
Alrighty, welcome to episode 13 of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. And Jeff, you know, you and I, you know, spend a lot of time talking with singer-songwriters and bands about their craft and how they do what they do. And I think you'll agree with me that the conversation we have on deck today is going to be a really interesting one, because I think that there's a lot of artists that are out there that are interested in, you know, how they can navigate through the business of being in the music business and, you know, deal with having success with a lot of different areas, including the area of music placement. And the person we're going to have with us today certainly has done, has navigated a lot of those areas successfully. And if we are to believe what we're reading, Jeff, she's actually making money doing it, which, so I think that there's a lot of folks that are listening to us that suddenly just perked up at the mention of making money.
I know, making money and making art. That sounds like science fiction right now, doesn't it?
So, yeah, so singer-songwriter Kathy Heller is our guest today, and, you know, we're stoked. I mean, the way this one came about was that, Jeff, you sent me an email, and you basically forwarded me, you know, some music and said, I like this a lot. And I wrote back, and I said, I like this a lot. And it's like, let's do something. So we're very pleased to have you here with us today, Kathy. How are you?
I'm so good. And who could, like, you know, not be happy when someone gives an introduction like that? It's like when you, when someone walks onto the set of a sitcom and there's like the canned clapping. That's how I feel. You guys just gave me that intro. That should happen for everybody when they walk in the house.
I promise not to call you Norm.
Okay. you guys are awesome. I'm pretty flattered, to say the very least. I've been telling my friends that, you know, oh, I'm gonna be on their show, and they've done such cool stuff. And you know, I feel like I should be interviewing you guys as opposed to you interviewing me, but I guess we'll save that for when I have a podcast.
I was going to say, we could certainly do that anytime, Kathy. You start asking the questions. We'll just, we'll see if we can come up with answers.
Okay. All right. Well, we might have to do a little bit of that. It'd be fun. Maybe we'll do that at the end.
Our intro really was just buttering you up to ask for, you know, if we could borrow some money. So
it's so funny. It's so funny you say that. The LA Weekly just did this story on me, and,
yeah, we read that this morning.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. And then, so one of my friends, his comment was, all right, now that you're making all, can I borrow $10,000? I'm like, I think they sort of overhype it, because, like, when you're making any decent amount of money in the music business, they make it sound like you're a millionaire, because I guess people don't, you know, make money in the business. But so I said, how do you want it? Do you want it in all ones, or do you want it in arcade tokens? So anyways, what should we talk about?
Well, I was going to say, can you talk about your initial path into the business and really, you know, what was it that you envisioned, you know, yourself doing real world? Like, you know, you're looking, you have dreams, all that kind of stuff. What was the initial path that you took as far as, you know, getting into the business? Did you, you know, did you just simply want to be a, you know, singer-songwriter and find success there? Or did you have, you know, greater goals beyond that? Where did it really start?
Well, you know, when I was, I guess, dreaming as a kid, ever since I was little, singing into my hairbrush and looking in the mirror, I always wanted to be a singer, songwriter, whatever that meant. So as a kid, the only thing you know is, you know, people on the radio. So you think, like, in terms of that. And when I finally got out here at 24 and kind of got out to LA to pursue this, the music that I was writing, I realized, was not these, like, big pop ballads that were going to be, you know, necessarily on the same plane as Kelly Clarkson or what was going on the radio at that time. And I was kind of confused at the moment, like, well, how am I going to, you know, do this? And the truth is that the thing that always inspired me the most specifically was soundtracks. The first CD I ever bought, I can't believe I'm going to one day tell my daughter that I was around before the CD, and that she's going to say, what's a CD? I only have MP3s, or whatever she's going to have. But the first CD I ever bought was a soundtrack. And I, you know, lived sort of through soundtracks. And I always stayed through the credits to find out who sang that song, you know, at the opening of, I remember staying and waiting when I was watching this movie, A League of Their Own, in like 1991, and wanting to know what that opening song was, and only played for like 35 seconds, and I, of course it was Carole King, which is why I loved the song, but it was like a new song she had just done. And so I called Colony Music in New York City and got the sheet music at the time when that was still something you could do, and waited for the soundtrack to come out to that movie, and then I got it. So I think I always had that, but I didn't know that was a job. Like, I didn't know you could just write music for film and TV and ads and stuff. And then, lucky for me, in like 2005, 2006, the industry started changing, and what seemed like a bad thing, where record companies started to have to redefine themselves because they were losing so much steam with the invention of the MP3 and iTunes, the record company started to sort of lose momentum, and there opened this whole world for indie songwriters to find a way into TV and film, because all of a sudden it was easier for them to get on TV with a placement than it was to get a record deal, because those were sort of stalled. And it was easier for the music supervisors at television shows to clear music from indie writers, because they were, you know, offering fees that they couldn't clear at Universal Publishing. And I started to see people like Ya'el Naim, who had a song on the Apple commercial, and it was such a beautiful tribute. It was like, talk about a music video, which doesn't happen anymore. It was like this beautiful music video to her song, and she was this indie writer. And then Ingrid Michaelson comes on, and she's got this Old Navy ad with this beautiful song, and it's not hokey, and it's not a jingle. It's like this great song, the way, you know, the way I am. And then I see Grey's Anatomy's like starting right then, and it's like one after another, all these new bands, Imogen Heap and Regina Spektor, and these people who, I mean, some of those people are signed, but they're definitely a little left of center. And then there's a ton of room on those shows for all these indie writers. I started saying, wow, maybe I actually do something that has a place. Maybe these like quirky songs that I write do have a spot. And that's when the light bulb went off, and I said, okay, so the million-dollar question is, that's what I want to do. How am I going to do it? And I was kind of clear at that moment that that was my path.
How'd you find your way at that point?
Well,
what really opened the door once you knew that, like, hey, this is where I need to go? You know, how did you go about like breaking in and like, you know, finding that entry point?
Well, that's a great question. And the thing is that I had a professor in college who said, you know, you can get anywhere you want. You just have to ask the right question. You just have to ask the right question and keep asking the right question. And I kept saying, okay, so how do I get from here to there? So I need my music to get to music supervisors. How do I do that? How do I find music supervisors? And then you keep asking questions, and you know, you get answers. You say, okay, well, I need either someone who knows music supervisors, or I need to connect with them myself. So the first approach I had was to find somebody who knew them, because I didn't know anybody at the time. So I started, you know, talking to different licensing companies, and that was a whole new world at the time, realizing that that was a whole industry, that there were so many companies that were already doing it. I was like, wow, I thought I just had this unique idea. It wasn't so unique. And I at the same time I was looking for licensing companies, I was in this ASCAP. ASCAP had a workshop every year, called the Lester Sill Writers Workshop, where they pick like 14 writers who they think have potential, and they really try to give you some wisdom as well as some experience collaborating with people who've really made it. Like, we met with Hal David, as well as Cara DioGuardi, as well as Lynn Grossman, who at the time was already Ingrid Michaelson's manager, and she had a company called Secret Road. Obviously that's gone on to be, she's sort of set the bar. Both Lynn and Ingrid have sort of set the bar for this entire path. So I started really studying what they were doing. And at the end of the Lester Sill workshop, we had a showcase, and they brought people to come hear us play. And one of the people who came to hear me play was this really handsome, charismatic guy, this guy, Marty Silverstone, who's now at a company called Primary Wave. And he was running the licensing department of this other company. And he said, I want to license your music. And I said, great. And at the time, you know, I was excited for anyone to do it. And he did great. In the first year that we worked together, he got me 11 placements. One was a Kodak ad, several TV shows, wow. A promo for NBC, which ran for The Office, Parks and Rec, Community, SNL. It ran for several months. I thought this was, oh my God, this is so easy, you know? So he then left that company to go to his promotion position, which is at another company. And I didn't go with him because it's a publishing company. And then I thought, great, so now what do I do? And I started looking for someone to replace him, and I realized it's not so easy because the two things you need in a person, and this is good for artists to know, you need two things in someone who's going to pitch your music. You need somebody who is so enthusiastic about your specific music. Not that they have a great roster and they have a great reputation pitching other people's songs. They need to be so excited about your specific songs that they can't help but make other people excited because it's so within them, it's so genuine. So they have to have that, number one. And number two is they have to be the type of person who gets to work early and leaves work late and takes the music supervisors out to Lakers games and goes to parties with them, not because they have to, because they genuinely love their job so much. And that's what he was. And it's not easy to find those two things. Sometimes you can find someone who has the second one, or someone who is psyched about other people's songs, and you say, well, I want to be part of that roster, but they're not really so psyched about what you do, and you kind of sit there. So for a couple years, I was like not signing with anyone because I couldn't find the person who I really believed in enough in terms of how much they believed in me. And then I said, you know what? I'm just going to do this myself. All right, so what's the second question? How do I meet music supervisors? And I think that's a great question for people to ask who want to place their music. How do you meet them? And I think the other important question is, how do I connect with them? As opposed to, how do I get something from them? And I think that's where the entire conversation shifts. If you approach anything in life as a business and about making money, then people know that. Everything that's coming from you is felt by everybody around you. That's just how life is. So you don't want to approach something by thinking to yourself, you know, I'm going to meet somebody and I'm going to get something from them. That's really not going to help you. And I think you have to look at your career like a long distance run, not like a sprint, and really be in it for the right reasons. And for me, music supervisors had been such an important part of my life, my whole life. I mean, I know the Dirty Dancing soundtrack inside and out. I know the soundtrack to Wayne's World inside and out. I learned who Queen was from watching Wayne's World because I know that like dates me, but I think I was 8 and it was like listening to Bohemian Rhapsody. I was like, this is such a cool song, Mom. She's like, yeah, it's been around for a long time. But music supervisors have made so many incredible memories for me. How many times are you listening to a song on the radio and the reason that you're welling up with whatever feeling it is, whether it's you're psyched or whether you're sad, whatever it is because you're reliving the scene. I mean, if you that song Chasing Cars by Snow Patrol, I can't listen to the song without picturing the stars of Grey's Anatomy making out, you know, to the song, or, you know, with or without you, I'm picturing Ross and Rachel, their first kiss on Friends is to that song. And I know the whole scene and I know exactly what she says. And she goes to the door and he says, this ship has sailed. And she says, that's fine. I don't need your stinking ship. And then she locks the door and she turns around and the song starts to play and you hear that amazing guitar and Bono starts to sing and she opens the door and they make out. And you're like, that's my whole high school was that moment. I mean, that took me through years. That got me through all the hard times. So like, my point is that music supervisors are not just people to me in terms of what can I get from you? They're people who, they've shaped my life. Similar, I'm sure, to people who loved E.T. growing up, and they love Steven Spielberg, not because just because he's a powerful guy, because he's such an incredible storyteller. So I didn't approach it like, great, I'm going to meet these people, I'm going to pitch them my songs, and I'm going to talk about myself, and hopefully they're going to make me some money. That's where everything ends. I looked at it like, what a thrill to start connecting with these people who I didn't even know as a kid existed. You know, as a kid, you just think all of it's put together by the magic of TV. you don't realize all the different people that go into making this what it is. And if you've ever watched something without music and then see it cut to music, it's completely lacking without the song.
So makes a huge difference.
I said, I'm going to now have an opportunity to try to connect with these people. And what a gift, you know, what a gift to try to understand, like, how they do what they do, what inspires them, what did they listen to, what music did they love that was in movies, what got them into it. And so that was really my approach, which was fun because it took the pressure off. It wasn't about make money, go. You know, it was like, let's go find these people and see if it's possible to connect with them. And so I started researching them. And I started from, again, a genuine place. What movies do I love? What TV shows do I love? Now let me go research who did the songs to them. Who plays the songs?
So
go ahead.
Here, there are two. Well, Matt and I were just saying to each other that as you're talking, there are all these questions that we have that are coming and going as you're bringing up all these great points about what you do. I think my first question goes way back to the start of what you were saying. You were talking about having 11 placements in the first year, and then the person who was pitching your music moves on. But at that point, it seems from the outside like somebody like you would be a commodity in your own right. Like, you wouldn't have to go out and find somebody to pitch music for you. People would be pitching you for the opportunity to pitch your music. But maybe in the context of television music placement, 11 placements in a year isn't that many.
Well, I think it actually is. I think the point is, my friend Jove here is like, no, it really is. I think the reason that I didn't sign with anyone, people came to me, but I realized that there were so many people who were eager to do it again, what Marty had done. There was, I don't want to call them out because they're all very decent, kind human beings. But right. They weren't able to do what he did because he doesn't sleep. He loves his job. He gets up and he's at the office way before because he just loves it. He's out every single night. He's that guy who loves to schmooze because he genuinely loves to schmooze. So you have to be that kind of a person. And he also was like before I even was cool, he kind of got that what I was doing was gonna be worthwhile. And so I had like four pretty reputable people come to me afterwards and say, you know, can we work on this? And with a couple of them I tried, like, non-exclusively just to see, and nothing. And I realized it's him. You know, you have to have the relationships. People have to answer your phone call, you know? And a lot of these people didn't have it. And I think maybe for the reason that I'm saying, because if you send someone an email and you're just blasting, you know, like a blast that you send to 200 people, it's really impersonal. Right. And music supervisors get that all day long. I doubt they even have time to do their own job that's on their desk, let alone read a quarter of the emails they get, let alone ones that come in that are just really impersonal. So that doesn't work. You can't do that. And I think most people don't take the time, or maybe they just don't realize their own innate value, that if they're just sincere and talk to people like a friend and a person, that people would care. So they think, oh, I just have to send them stuff about the business. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It makes perfect sense. And the fact that you reached out to me that way made all the difference in terms of me taking the time to listen to your music instead of just deleting it outright. I mean, I'm sure there are many people who get more pitches than I do in a given day, but
I'm sure you get a ton.
I get a lot. I get a ton, and so does Matt. And the fact that you actually wrote instead of just sending out a form letter, made all the difference.
And that means so much to me because it makes me feel like the time I'm spending sitting there being like excited to write to you is like felt. And you know, before I wrote to you a couple months ago, I was on the phone with a couple PR people who were like, you know, if you give me $1,500 a month or $2,000 a month, I'll, you know, I'll send your music to a list of 2,000 or whatever they tell you. And it's this and that, and the influence is great. And I said, you know what? That is so not me. Like, I,
right.
You know, I don't want that. Even if it meant that you're going to get a a wider response, I don't want to be that person. I like to find people who I respect and connect with you. And I didn't write to everybody because I obviously can. I'm one person with two hands. But I do the research and find who is compelling and interesting. And then you also happen to be so kind and nice. And right away, I was like, oh, this guy is awesome. But I genuinely did that. And that's exactly the point is not everybody does that. And I think that would be my advice to people who are doing anything, any job. But especially in this business where people, I think, feel a little bit taken advantage of on the receiving side. Like if you're a supervisor or you're a PR, you know, a writer or an editor, or you have your podcast, I think it's a little bit like rude almost to just be like all day long hearing people say, "Hi, Jeff, let me talk to you about me. I just put out a record." You're like, okay, great. It better be really good because all that's in here is you pitching me something, so it better be good. All I'm getting from you is something for me to do for you. There's nothing in it for you. I tried to ask people like you, I was like, you know, what are you listening to? Who do you like? Who do you think right now is good? What's in your car? Like, you know, I genuinely cared because I'm thinking, wow, these people have done a lot. They're really good writers. They're good with people in terms of knowing what music is good. I'm curious what they think. They probably know more than me. So I think it's important to approach business not as a numbers game, but as a people's game, and have a genuine interest in the people that you want to do business with, and make a relationship be the priority as opposed to make money be the priority.
Well, if you're ready, why don't you do a couple of songs for us, and you can tell us a little bit about each one before you play it.
Okay, awesome. I'm going to play songs from the new record that I sent you, and I collaborated with, like, I think two or three different writers on the record, and one of them was my friend Dove Rosenblatt. He's
Hi, guys.
He's a sweet. He's all those things I was just saying, a person. He really is. I always say, did you just have, like, such yummy parents? Because he's so good. And he did. I met his dad, and he's, like, a doll. So, Sorry, Mom. Your mom was horrible. Yeah. I'm just kidding. I never knew this one. All of a sudden, you're like, that girl went from being so sweet to just terrible. So we're going to play a couple songs. This first song we're going to play is called Fragile Heart. And should I talk? Well, I should just sing it, right? Sure. You want me to tell you about it, or we should just sing it?
Tell us a little bit about the song. That'd be great.
So this song, I think, is about...
is this the first one we wrote? I think so.
I think this is.
I just have to say that Kathy is also... I mean... We met through a mutual friend who's also a writer and producer, and his first email was just introducing us, like, I know you guys are gonna co-write well together. And I went over to Kathy's house and we just instantly hit it off, and everything that she's saying, I mean, she's also extremely modest, and I think it takes a special person to have all of these, like, genuine beliefs and act on them, and we just hit it off right away and immediately started connecting about very real, deep personal things, like, right away.
Yeah.
And then this song happened.
Yeah, and this was the first song we wrote, and I think this song is about everybody in the world, in terms of it's the most terrifying human universal thing to be in love and to be loved. And as tough as we all can act and look, and you walk down the street and everybody's got their Ray-Bans and looks like they're all put together, at the end of the day, like, if someone tries to get legitimately close and get to know you in a real way, it's like the most terrifying thing. So I think we're all a little bit fragile on the inside, and I think we all just want and need a lot of compassion from each other if we're, you know, in a relationship, because we're all just doing the best we can. And so that's what this song is about.
Cool.
Yeah, here we go. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
stay and wait until I make it safe and sound. Show me you are sure and I'll show up at your door.
We're still here.
You want us to go into the next song?
Sure, yeah. And if you want to talk about that one too.
Okay, this next song is called Crazy in Love. And I'm totally going to call my husband out and he's going to say, Cap, I hate being talked about. He's the type of person who feels a ton, but he kind of likes to keep it close to the vest, which I think is, to be fair, very common among some guys.
I thought you were going to say, like, admirable or something.
Oh.
You're like, no, it's just common.
That's so funny. Did you already say? He's like, I thought you were going to say it's, like, very admirable. You're like, no, it's just not unique. It's common. So I wrote a song about the fact that, you know, I want to scream it out loud. I want to shout it from the rooftops and write it in the sky and dance in the rain and, you know, kiss in the corner of the crosswalk. And he's always like, Cap, you know? Relax, yeah. You know? So I kind of wrote this about that. Yeah.
Kiss me in the sunshine, let the whole world know. Make me come alive like we don't care when people stare. In the sky, whisper in my ear, always there, everywhere. We can't let this thing grow old too soon. I wanna be crazy in love while we're still young. I wanna be crazy, insanely in love. I wanna be crazy.
me till the morning. Look up at the sky while the world is sleeping. Wake instead, we'll stay in bed.
Huddle close together while the rain comes down. Share an umbrella, baby, don't go away.
I can't let this thing grow all too soon. I wanna be crazy in love.
Insert the sound of stadium cheering right there.
Oh my gosh, I can feel it. Wow, that was amazing.
We always like to give the impression that we actually tape these shows in a giant arena, which we do, so they'll continue to get that impression. Well, I know that I know Jeff has a question about a specific part of your songwriting, but I guess I'll get back into things with a couple of things. And just ask the question that, you mentioned Carole King. I'm just curious to know that, being 8 years old in 1991, which I think would be the timeline for Wayne's World, artistically, who were the important artists that you were hearing that really, drove your overall songwriting as far as the stuff that kind of influenced you?
I mean, I feel like I'm so not, original, but I would... The records that I loved were Carole King and Joni Mitchell Blue, and I love the Indigo Girls. I saw them, I think, more than anyone. I think I've seen them like 6 times, and I was lucky to be a part of the generation when Sarah McLachlan did Lilith Fair. I think I was like middle school, so I went a ton, and that was incredible. I mean, I got to see, I saw Lilith Fair 3 times, and Natalie Merchant, who's someone I love, I'm a big fan of hers. In fact, she's probably, of all of those gals, I probably was most influenced by her because she has an ability to be whimsical and also introspective in a kind of, that whole record with Wonder and that whole Tiger Lily record is very, it could be current. Like, she could put that out today and it would work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, it's like you mentioned two folks right there, Natalie Merchant and Indigo Girls, that they are interesting songwriters. I think that they were making music that came out, certainly Natalie with 10,000 Maniacs and Indigo Girls came out at a time where it wasn't necessarily popular, to do, what they were doing. So that's certainly one good influence to, pick up. But as far as the others, like you mentioned, Carole King and, Joni Mitchell, where did those records, come into your collection? Who introduced you to those records?
Oh, that's a sweet question. My mom is actually a musician, and she plays piano, and she actually teaches piano also. And we had an actual, record player with a great record collection that she had growing up. Her father was also a performer, and back in the day when people used to go to the Catskills, and that was a big deal, he used to like to get up and perform, and so that was sort of all passed on, I guess. She had the Carole King records, and I think the Joni Mitchell record, though, I think I got on my own because I had a friend who's actually from Maine, near where you are, Jeff, and he was just cooler than all my other friends, and I had met him at sleepaway camp, and he had the Joni Mitchell. People in New England are cooler than everywhere else. They're hipsters way before hipsters, because they have the cool sweaters with the elbow patches, and you know it's cold, so they're busy doing finding other cool things to do, like listen to music and stuff. So yeah, that's where I got those records.
I wanted to go back to something that you were talking about before you performed, about kind of the emotional power that a song can wield when it's used at the right moment in a movie or a television show. And I wonder, as a songwriter, it seems like if you're trying to recapture that kind of thing, and I know that a lot of your songs do talk about big emotions, it seems like it might create sort of a chicken and the egg type of question where, you know, you're trying to make music that works in those situations. How hard is it to keep that organic? You know, I mean, do you ever sit down and sit and think, well, I'm going to write a song that'll sound great in Pretty Little Liars or whatever, or are you always drawing from your own personal well, so to speak?
I mean, I think that's a really fair and honest question. Dove just brought me coffee because he's so sweet. He's going in the room. But still, that was nice. Would you like a foot rub?
And he didn't throw it on you. He didn't throw it on you, which means your relationship is, you know, still pretty
still
good.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that collaborative spirit is still alive.
Still hanging in. We'll see what happens by the end of the hour. It's anybody's guess. I think that's a really fair question. I think, you know, I wouldn't be intellectually honest if I said I'd never thought of that question. But the truth is, like,
well, you know, because that's the knock on this type of music. I mean, that's what everybody, that's like the preconceived notion for this kind of stuff,
yeah,
is that it's
right.
Been to a formula.
I think the thing is that if you tried to write something that would be good for something,
right,
you would be worse off, because here's the thing. It's kind of a complex issue, because these guys, like Chris Moyer, who's the music supervisor on Vampire Diaries and Pretty Little Liars, he's cool. Like, he's cooler than me. he knows all the new stuff that's out. He knew Edward Sharp before Edward Sharp came out, you know? So you can't write something that's hokey that you think is good for his scene and then he's going to like it because it sounds contrived. It has to be cool, and you have to be coming from a cool place, or else he's not going to put it on his show. And the song that I actually got on Pretty Little Liars was a song I had written 2 years before, when I didn't even know what Pretty Little Liars was. And I couldn't believe it. That was the song he called me about, because I had pitched him every other song I had. He's like, no, you have this other song. Can I use that? I said, sure. And I had recorded that in my friend's bedroom. This is before I started working with my current producer, who has like an amazing studio and setup. And he's like, yeah, that's the song I want. I'm like, okay. So that's one answer to your question. I think the other answer to your question is the following. I think that something that's, you know, good for artists to keep in mind if they want to do placements, and at the same time, something that's not a formula, but rather a secret to success, is that, you know, Einstein, there's a great quote I had over my desk in college. Einstein said, if you are really brilliant about something, you should be able to explain it to a 5-year-old. You ever heard that quote? I don't know.
Jeff,
like,
says that to me all the time. I didn't know what it meant till now.
Well, like, my father, God bless him, he's like so, he's very smart, and, you know, he's a forensic psychologist, and sometimes when he talks about cases he's doing, he like pontificates. There's 6 words I scribble down that I have no idea what he's talking about, and I have to go back and say, Dad, first of all, I don't know what you're talking about. Second of all, why are we talking about this murder when we're trying to eat dinner? But anyways, the point being is that if you want to be successful in licensing, I think one thing I've heard people say about my music, which actually came out of just the way that I write, and then I realized it was a good thing, is people have said to me, it's very accessible. John Houlihan, who's a great friend and a very decent guy and a great music supervisor, done a ton of movies, including all the Austin Powers, including Letters to Juliet, including What's Expecting You're Expecting recently, and he does the current show Vegas. He's great, and he's the person who said to me, your songs are accessible. I said, what does that mean? He said, it means that you don't You don't self-indulge in a story that's so specific to something about you in the words that you're writing that I couldn't use it in a scene that's about someone else's story. And so I think that that's one key. And when I was first writing, I thought that actually was a detriment to my success. I thought that the Indigo Girls were so much cooler because they're poets. If you listen to, you know, Rites of Passage or Swamp Ophelia, there's not a song that goes by where you're like, geez, listen to what they just said. It's just like an incredible lyric, you know? You get it. My songs are not as sophisticated. So I thought that was not good. I found out for licensing, that's really good. To have a hook where you know, it just says, we're good together, you know, which is a song on my new album. They love that. It's like, great, we're good together could be in anything. It could be in a cereal commercial. It wound up being in a Words with Friends commercial. It's currently running, but it could also be, you know, in any scene, in any movie. And so I guess what I used to think growing up made me not a cool songwriter when I'd be like playing for my friends. I thought, oh, these are like such simple songs. I realized the simple is good for licensing.
Well, simple is also not quite as simple as it seems. I mean, I was just talking to one of the guys who co-wrote The Flame for Cheap Trick.
Wow.
And we were talking about kind of that delicate alchemy between the simple formula and knowing how to tell a personal story. I mean, he wrote the lyrics based on something that he had experienced, but it came out, as you say, simple enough for everybody to understand. You know, we were talking about power ballads, which were really big back in the 80s and then kind of suffered from their own popularity and people thinking that it was as easy as you know, watercolors or whatever. There was pure formula, which is kind of the way that some people think about music that they hear on some of the television shows that we're talking about.
Right.
And I wonder if you see kind of this phenomenon where music placement directors are sort of the new FM program directors.
It's a good way to look at it.
But I wonder if you see that trend kind of eating itself at some point.
What do you mean? I want to understand the question better.
Reaching enough of a saturation level that it goes the way of the power ballad, I guess, or you know, kind of what happened to power ballads in that
right.
Anybody who had one that was a hit, it almost became sort of a double-edged sword.
I think I understand what you're saying. I think that's exactly why you can't come at it from a place of a formula.
Yeah.
I think like the songs that I've had that have been the most successful in terms of licensing success are the songs where we don't think about what's being used on the show,
right,
or on the ad, but we go into the studio and we say, we're going to genuinely have a blast today and we're going to put that through the recording. And what winds up happening is you get these recordings that sound like the Lumineers, Hey Ho. You get these recordings that sound like Fun or Philip Phillips, where you say to yourself, oh, these people were just in a room and having fun. And that sound has now become, it's pretty amazing, actually. When I watched the Grammys this past month, I was
it really is.
I was so inspired because the old stuff is sort of going away, and the stuff that's taking over is Mumford & Sons and of Monsters and Men and... like we just said, the Lumineers and Fun, and all those guys are people who are coming out saying, this is just me. This ain't no formula. Now, maybe that's going to become a formula, right? Because it's like, that sounds becoming popular. People are going to pick up a banjo and people are going to pick up and, you know, hand claps. But that's why you have to sort of, you know, I think it goes back to what we were saying in the beginning when it comes to people and talking to people. If you show up and you commit 100% to being genuine, if there happens to be a spark of talent that was going to get you anywhere anyway, if you happen to be committed to who you are, but committed, if there happens to be talent in there, that's the only way you're going to actually get anywhere. Not by trying to be somebody else, because people see right through that. Oh, you're trying to sound like Florence and the Machine. Oh, you're trying to sound, and you're not going to be her. And her sound, again, that's a great example, actually, of somebody who's like, I don't have a formula. My songs have 7 parts. I have a bridge, and then I have another bridge that it goes into a down chorus, then the drums completely stop, and the swells come in from an orchestra. It's like, what is that? I don't know. It's amazing. That's why it's amazing, because it sounds new. So, you know, when we were kids and we used to finger paint or whatever the heck we did, we didn't have this self-conscious part of our brain that stepped in and said, you know, I better make it look like Tommy's painting because his mom put his on the fridge. It's like, no, you just like threw color on the page, and when you were legitimately having fun, it was so obvious, and she's like, I'm putting that one on the fridge. That one's so good. And you have to do that as an adult, and it's kind of interesting because you have that as a kid, and then everything in the world starts to teach you to do the opposite and to try to think with the end in mind and pre-plan things to the point where you overthink things. And if a song I'm writing takes me more than 40 minutes to write, I that's not good. It should just come. Like, I'm talking to you right now. I'm not planning what I'm saying. And not to say that it's brilliant, but that's not my goal. My goal is just to be genuine. You know, if my goal is to be brilliant, I'd be screwed. Because who could say what's brilliant?
Well, that's a noble goal. I think it's that sincerity that sets your music apart.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Because that's what I love about the people that I listen to, is I feel like that's just who they are. And then I get a little glimpse into them. It's like, great. You know, I mean, that's the problem with some pop music, is you just don't know who you're listening to. Is that really them, or is that a character they're playing? I don't know. I don't know if Lady Gaga really is that, but it's darn catchy, and it's really good pop, and there's a place for that, and there's a place for being a character too. You know, there's a place for, you know, wearing stage makeup and giving people like a spectacle. That's something totally different. But I think there's a way to do both. I was pretty darn impressed with Beyonce at the Super Bowl, because she has this inner self. It's so obvious. Like, even I thought more so than Madonna, who should in quotes, you know, I mean, everybody's insecure, but you know, thinking of who she is, she could be so at ease because the world kind of has embraced her. Here was Beyonce, like half her age, just like, you just feel that even though she sings pop music, she is so confident and able to be herself in front of the world. And it was like very inspiring to me. I think that's why she's so successful.
Well, you know, you talked about being in both worlds, and I'm going to take that concept of both worlds and go a different place. You know, according to that LA Weekly article, you placed 28 songs last year, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, that's incredible.
Such
that's
a blessing.
Certainly, if 11 is a lot, then 28 is certainly that much better.
It must make going to the mailbox a lot more fun.
and yet you have this new album, Breaking Free, which comes out in April, so we can be correct about things.
Yep.
It's April, right?
April 30th, yeah.
So, you know, working as much as you do in the area that you do, you know, do you still ride the line between, you know, being a musician for hire and, you know, being an artist who makes records? I mean, are parts of those worlds, you know, together? I mean, I guess I was just curious, like, as much work as you do in the one field, if you just saw yourself as a traditional artist who still made records, or if you kind of moved on from that definition.
I mean, I love that question, because that's exactly the question I asked, which led me to this record, because I was busy writing songs and then pitching songs, and in that cycle that I was getting success from it, I wasn't stopping doing it, because it was just, it was working. So I said, okay, next week I'll go back and write another song, and then I'll pitch it again. And da, da, da. And I got to a point where I said, wait a minute, you know, I'm writing all these songs. They're not in an album. I put out a couple EPs, but basically, I haven't been able to connect with the world and with my fans as a human being who has a whole story. What's happened is the people who know me are, it's all piecemeal. It's all broken up by fans of different shows. So I get emails from fans of Switch to Birth and fans of Pretty Liars and fans of One Tree Hill and, you know, different people and say, oh, can I use this song for my wedding? I heard it in the episode. It's so sweet. And I thought, wait a minute. This is so great that people love these shows and I'm happy to be a part of these shows, but I want to connect with them so that whatever it is that I have to say that could possibly be inspiring or uplifting or, you know, just a place for people to heal if my songs are, you know, about sad things, they're going to miss them because they're only going to know me by the song in the scene.
So yeah, that's an interesting problem to have.
What'd you say?
That's an interesting problem to have.
Yeah, and I said, you know, I really need to be spending some time on my artist project and putting out a full record and telling the whole story and letting people see me as a full person. So that's when I put out Breaking Free. I mean, it's kind of backwards in one sense, the fact that I've had all these placements and success, and I've only put out EPs at this point. I haven't put out a record yet. Like, it's just kind of strange. So I'm putting out this record April 30th, and currently I'm already three songs into my next record because I'm working on the sophomore record, because that really now is my goal, is to switch it around and put out the records and then, you know, God willing, continue to have success licensing this stuff, but to make the first priority getting to my fans, getting to the world, you know, telling the story first.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that question because I think you probably know, you know, that there are people that do what you do that just don't care about the artist side of things and making that connection. So, you know, but at the same time, I could see that, like, there could be somebody like you that, you know, had that frustration because it is an area that you want to, you know, connect. And I really didn't think about, you know, and you fleshed it out really good, the fact that there are so many people that are just connected to you through one show and not across everything that you're doing with all the shows. Because, you know, as a fan, how do you follow that? You really can't.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
yeah,
we're in an area where it's like, it seems like it's a lot, you know, to ask people to buy an album and sit through an entire album. So you have some artists out there that are going, you know, it's like, I almost want to do singles, but it's like the attention span isn't there to, like, release a single now and then another single next month and another single the month after
that.
Right. You know, so there's a lot of folks that are stoked going, you know, where do I go? Because it's like, I want to do this, you know, and probably the best thing for me to do would be to do this because their attention span isn't there. But at the same time, I want to do something that makes impact with them long term as an artist.
Yeah, and I think that's really well said. I think that you can't really neglect either one, because if you neglect the second one, which we're talking about now, I think you lose a lot of integrity and you lose the big picture of why you're doing this in the first place, because it's not about... If it's about making money, then good luck. That's not really going to sustain you for a lifetime and keep you inspired. And that wasn't what it started out being. I mean, since I was a kid running around with a tape recorder writing music at 6 and 7 and 12, and it wasn't about that. So it can't start being about that now, or else I won't be inspired to keep just sharing my feelings.
Well, I think we hit a point where we need to, you know, wrap up. You know, what do you want folks to know about as we leave here?
Well, I want people to know, since you started out talking about songwriters, you know, when you said, you know, oh, making money and, you know, inspiring people, I want people to know that if they have a dream and something sincere to share, that what's personal is universal and that they should keep sharing it. And I want them to feel that even though the world seems a little confusing how to get from here to there, hopefully now they have a little bit of a sense of, you know, you can just reach out to people and come from a good place. And I want people to be inspired to do that and pursue being them. and showing up in the world as them. And I guess for myself, I want them to know that I feel so grateful that I get to do this. I think about it all the time, how lucky I am that my work never feels like I did a day's work. It's so much fun, and that's how everyone's life should be if you're working. And if you come from that place, then hopefully the money will just come, and if not, at least you're having fun anyway, so who cares about, you know, eating sushi? Like, leave it, just enjoy your life. Life is too short. And I guess I want them to know that there's more coming, and my record will hopefully show them that the girl who has songs in Special K commercials is a real human being with fears and vulnerability and a lot of unanswered questions, and we'll get to know more about all that, and hopefully we can continue on this journey together just as humans and figure it out together.
Beautifully put.
Well, cool. Kathy Heller has been our guest here on the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour today, and of course, as we've talked about here, you can pick up her new album, Breaking Free, on April 30th. KathyHeller.com is the place to find all of the info on all things Kathy Heller, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you so much for, you're just both so attentive and present, good listeners. I mean, you're good with women, I'll tell you. Women love this. And you also ask such great questions. But we need to have coffee or lunch or something next time I'm in Cleveland and New Hampshire, because it's really awkward for me to spend an hour talking about myself and how much I love connecting with people, and then I have no idea really what makes you tick or what you ate for lunch or, you know, what your kids' names are. So that feels a little unfinished.
I would love to do this again too.
Well, you're a doll.
I think there's a couple hours left of things to talk about here.
Well, same here. So the next part needs to be me interviewing you guys. I'm not kidding. Someone should do that one time, because I should ask you why you're inspired and what music you love and what makes you love certain music and why you want to put certain people on the show. I think people would be really inspired by that.
You're going to just have Matt talking for an hour about Sammy Hagar and Foreigner, so be prepared for that.
That's awesome. Foreigner.